Commander Repard, Real 16. We were talking about HMS Byron, where you were first lieutenant, and sort of running through various aspects of the ship. And you mentioned the Aztec plotting room, and that sort of brings us to generally the bridge arrangements and the commands, the central command area of the bridge and the thing. How did this all link together?
Well, describing the bridge, first of all, there was the gyro compass repeater, which was in the center towards the front of the bridge. There was a magnetic compass just abaft that, in case the main one broke down. And then under the front of the bridge and sticking out, it's a tiny compartment, which was the Aztec room, where the operators sat, two of them. They couldn't concentrate for more than about 15 minutes at a time, so they changed over the duty of actually transmitting and controlling the direction on which the transmissions were made. Then below the bridge, on the deck below, there was a plot, which in these ships was very small indeed, but it had an Admiralty plotting table in it, which kept a sort of course and speed with a light moving across underneath a glass surface, and the whoever was down there running the plot would be putting little pencil marks or chinagraph pencil marks where this thing had been. And that position was then checked on a chart. And above that, again, there was a chart room where the navigator had his kept his charts and was responsible for the navigation of the ship. For the during a watch, the navigator might not be there, so the officer of the watch was responsible to the captain for the navigation and of knowing where the ship was, and occasionally when we were near land, taking bearings of points of land or lighthouses or whatever it happened to be. And indeed, if we were out of sight of land, then of course sextants and star sights and sun sights and so on came into it. And that was something we were all meant to be able to do. The Aztec bit, which was of course the main role of these ships, was detecting submarines, and we had the weaponry to deal with submerged submarines as well. I think if the submarines had come to the surface and fired back at us, it would have been slightly more difficult, because they were extraordinarily difficult to hurt with gunfire, because they had pressure hulls which were very thick, and in any case the pressure hull was mostly underwater, even when the conning tower was up. So you had a tiny target to aim at in the submarine. However, I never came across that, although there were submarines which did come up and fight it out, especially, I think, in the Pacific.
Now, just another thing, signal and arrangements. There are various types of signal and telegraphists, and they also have these special telegraphists, the Hufduffs, HFDF sets. And did you have one on the...
We had Hufduff in Byron, high-frequency direction finding. It was intended to detect the German U-boats making signals. And, of course, Admiralty had direction-finding systems ashore. And if we could detect these signals at sea, we might get a bearing and therefore help to fix the position of a German submarine transmitting at a particular time. The Germans were reducing the length of their signals to make it more difficult for us to get a bearing, and they used a technique of writing the signal out and then squashing it electronically. So it was called squash to make it a very abbreviated transmission, a matter only of a few seconds, and therefore very difficult to detect, because you first of all had to guess which frequency this thing would be made on, and that was controlled to some extent by where it was made from and which frequency would be best for the Germans to reach their own receiving stations. But it did require a bit of skill, and the time we were at sea, they were introducing squash transmissions and making it more difficult for us to do that. On the other hand, we had introduced long-range anti-submarine aircraft, which were keeping the Germans down more, and they weren't able to move freely on the surface. So they were countering that by introducing the ability to run submerged with just the snorkel sticking up to keep the diesel engines running. So they had their batteries topped up. So it was a to-and-fro swaying battle of the technologies, as well as the battles at sea and the use of the technologies intelligently. When it all worked perfectly together, it was jolly good. When it didn't, you could make an absolute pig's ear of it awfully easily. And we were receiving every night, out in the Atlantic anyway, an admiralty chart showing where they thought the submarine packs were, or where the submarines were. But 1944, that I'm talking about now, the submarines had started to operate inshore. And the advantage to the submarine was that they were positioned in areas where ships had to concentrate in order to get into the right ports. And if you're going to Liverpool, you probably were going around the north of Ireland. And if you're going down to the southwest, you go down the south of Ireland. If you're aiming to go to Iceland, there are very few ways to go except straight. They knew, therefore, where to concentrate. And because they could operate inshore with the snorkels, without being detected on radar so easily, we knew much better where they were. And we were at last equipped with enough ships, and this was the tremendous advantage of the destroyer escorts, that they deployed anti-submarine detection devices and good anti-submarine weaponry. We had enough to operate offensively against the submarines for the first time. And it was very good for morale to feel that we were doing that. But initially, Byron was deployed in the East Coast convoy.
I'll be coming to that. Just the last section is that they were almost uniquely powered at the time in the Royal Navy. They didn't have the sort of engine you were used to in Tartar.
Well, some did, some didn't. There were the steam turbine engines, turbo-electric, and there were the diesel electrics. The steam turbines had to be, of course, flashed up and warmed up before they could go to sea. The diesel boats could, like a motor car, switch them on and they went. I wasn't perturbed by Byron having it, because it had steam, in fact. It was one of those. And we rather looked sideways at the diesel ones making funny noises compared to us. And you could tell from your ASDIC set from quite a long distance which sort it was, because the diesel engines made a different noise. Didn't worry me one little bit. They weren't terribly fast, of course, and nothing like as fast as the tribals, for example, which had 35 knots or thereabouts.
But do you think they were fast enough to do their job? I mean,
they were fast enough. They were faster than the corvettes we'd deployed. The corvettes could be outrun on the surface by a submarine on the surface pretty well. We were fast enough to deter the submarines from surfacing and trying to run for it on the surface.
Now, just other things. The crew accommodation was different aboard.
Yes, they the ship's company, mess decks, were all bunks. And they had reading lights in the bunks and funny things which we'd never seen, of course, in the Royal Navy before.
Things like they had a water cooler on some of them.
There were some drinking fountains so that you could endlessly get little plastic mugs, if you had enough plastic mugs, that is, and have water that way.
And a laundry?
There was a small laundry, so there was less washing of everything in buckets. But there were some older sailors who'd always wash their smalls in the buckets every single day and their socks, who went on doing so. Tradition and all that. Wasn't just a theory, it was practice for some people.
What did you think of these U.S. this sort of the bunk, I mean, for the men being in bunks, which is different, the water cooler, the laundry, were you for it or against it? Or
I was there essentially to fight a war. If the sailors could be delivered drier or more comfortable or whatever at the right time in the right place, that was great.
What about the messing system for the men? Because there seems to be some confusion.
Cafeteria messing was different. It meant that we could actually provide better food with less work for the sailors, because in Sheffield, originally, we had messing was done by the cook of the mess, and he had to prepare the food and take it up to the galley to be cooked. If you do it centrally, it's much more efficient. The food can be better quality, And indeed, you can provide more food for a given price because you can do it in quantity. So I think that was no doubt it was the right way ahead. And as you got more and more equipment provided to facilitate that, the product was undoubtedly better. But when you're railing 40-odd degrees either side and back in such a short time, what you're more concerned about is whether you're ever going to keep the plate on the table long enough to eat it. And I think there were other things which felt more important to the sailors.
Just picking up a couple more random points now. You mentioned the Oerlikons. What about the anti-aircraft defences of the ship?
Well, compared to Tata, they were virtually non-existent. The existence of the Oerlikons meant that you could put some tracer up in the air, and there are only, I think, about three or four Oerlikons in the ship. Unlike those who were permanently deployed in the North Sea, we didn't have an Oerlikon right forward, or a Beaufort's right forward for dealing with E-boats, because we were going back to northern to the western approaches. But while we were in the swept channels off the east coast, I would have felt happier if we'd had something forward, because with the bows sweeping up rather far, you couldn't shoot at anything right forward very close to the ship. So if an E-boat got jolly close in, there was nothing you could do about it except throw beer cans at it or something. Luckily, that didn't happen. When we did have some E-boats, they were secured to buoys in the swept channel, and I think they were as frightened of us as we were of them. They went away.
Now, what was your overall impression of the ship then, having joined her? I mean, it obviously wasn't
My concern was, as always, I think, more with the people than with the things. I was concerned that the ship's company had a lot to learn by the time I got there, especially the seamen end of the ship's company and the officers. And I was glad to see that the engineer officer appeared to be a competent, experienced man and able to deliver the speed and the engines when we needed it and to keep them going. The old gunner regarded the whole thing as something which was outside his experience, and he would do the best he could, and he was terribly good at trying awfully hard. But he'd been brought up in a school where the Royal Navy did things this way, and there was no other way of doing it. So flexibility of the older people, as I now know to my cost, was less so than it was for the younger ones. And one had to lean on the younger ones, say, this is the way we're going to do it in this ship. It doesn't really matter what you'd had before or what you might have in future. This is the one we're doing.
Now, one thing that there seems to have been a variety of approaches to the actual appearance of the captain's class. And some first lieutenants who seem to be in charge of this painted the ship every time it stopped moving, and sometimes while it was moving, and others seem to have almost taken pride in looking like they've been recently sunk. And the photographs show this as well.
Yes.
I wondered what your opinion was, whether you tried to keep the ship as clean as possible and painted as possible, or whether you were not worried by outward appearance.
Well, interestingly, I don't recognise what you're saying. If a ship was looked a mess, then the odds were it had had a rough time and there was something wrong. I don't know of any ship which would have willingly looked in a mess if it was about to be inspected or if the captain had pride in it. And if a captain didn't have pride in a ship, the paint was actually secondary. There would be something very wrong in the ship's company indeed. And I think that leadership came into this thing somewhere. And personally, I would not put up with anything looking unnecessarily dirty. But if you'd been to sea for 3 weeks and there'd water all over everything and there was a bit of rust or whatever, so there was a bit of rust, and when there was time, you'd deal with it. But the first thing you'd do would be to get the stores in and be ready to go to sea again.
So it was you had a practical approach to it?
Yes. I think the question which had to be foremost in one's mind was, what was the objective? The objective was to have an efficient ship available to go to sea and do its stuff and to use the equipment provided as well as possible. And that meant having a trained ship's company all pointing in the same direction and understanding why they were doing it. In fact, motivation and all the things one talks about when under leadership. And that was far more important than polishing something, although every now and then you'd find someone who loved having a shiny gun or a shiny something else, in which case you'd say, how lovely that looks. Well done.
Now, what about that? When you joined them in January and 44, and your first operations were on the East Coast, is that, is that the first thing you recall doing?
Yes, we went up and down the East Coast Swept Channel, which I had not been in before. And it was an alarming sight. There were wrecks everywhere because the German magnetic mine offensive in 1940 had absolutely sewn us up on that coast, and there were merchant ships with their masts and funnels sticking out. It's very shallow on the East Coast, and the swept channel went inside the, on the mainland side of the Goodwin Sands. And there were, on the way out of the Thames Estuary, turned north, one might see 8 or 10 sunken ships there, which made the point that this place is dangerous. Occasionally there would be airplanes come over and top up the mines at night. But we are talking about a time when we were beginning to get the initiative in the war. We were working up to the invasion, which was to come comparatively soon. And the swept channel was not only full of fairly small convoys, taking goods and supplies and all the rest of it. It had the most extraordinary bits of material being towed about. We didn't know what they were. Things like enormous great cotton reels, 50, 60 feet high by the look of them, being towed by ordinary dockyard tugs on long wire. And we'd no idea what they were. It turned out to be the Pluto pipeline reels going down south towards the Solent. Great big chunks of concrete being towed about, which we subsequently found out was part of the Mulberry Harbour. But we would be escorting these sometimes, or we'd see them anchored in the Solent. And conceptually, we weren't clever enough to be able to put together two and two and make four out of it.
Now, what exactly were you doing in the... Were you actually just... Were you going with convoys, or were you just patrolling?
With convoys. Our role was to protect these very important bits of equipment or ships going up and down that swept channel and protect them from primarily E-boats at that time. We wouldn't have been able to protect much against air attack, and in any case the German air appeared to be more occupied doing other things because they were up the neck in Russia by then.
And what were the, Nate, what was the, how did you counter E-boats? Do you see what I mean? What was the...
You hoped that the radar echo you were getting was a channel buoy, and if it looked a bit bigger than usual, you hoped it wasn't an E-boat secured to the channel buoys, because they used to arrive, secure to a channel buoy, turn their engines off, so you couldn't hear them on the Aztec. And you didn't know for sure that what they were until suddenly the engines roared into life. We didn't, in Byron, come across that more than once. And although we fired things off into the blue, I don't think we hit anything. And we were probably in great danger of hitting a convoy. We certainly frightened ourselves doing it. It was, they weren't those sort of ships, really. But it was a good way of bringing the ship's company together, because they, that was the working up period, in effect. We had... no real exciting contacts with the enemy at all. They were always on the verge of being there. We could hear on the radio that they, it was happening somewhere else.
So how many would the, how many escorts would there be, and how many in the convoy, and usually?
Three or four ships, perhaps. Small number, very small numbers of ships. Or small numbers of bits of equipment, and maybe one or two of us, one in the front, one in the back.
And another captain, or would there be something with more
usually
guns?
Usually we had another captain, or sometimes they had minesweepers, of course, were out there in heaps, operating to keep the channel clear of mines.
What anti-mine precautions had you taken, or could you take? Were you degaussing?
We were degaussed, and the ship had degaussing equipment fitted. We hoped that that would deal with magnetic mines.
Did you know how it worked?
Yes, we knew how the ship had been over the I don't know what were they called, the degassing range, where the ship's magnetic signature was measured, and then the wires around the ship were then either flashed to make the signature different, or continually pulsed to keep it different. And I don't remember which it was in Byron. But we were increasingly aware that there were mines which were acoustic mines as well, and some of them were either acoustic or magnetic, and some were acoustic magnetic, so they required both the signatures, which were much more difficult to sweep. We hadn't at that stage reached the pressure mines. They were coming in a little later, I think.
Did mines worry people? Because it's the sort of thing that can prey on people's minds.
I think if you were worrying about anything, you could find that you would go around the bend very quickly. You couldn't afford to worry all that much. And looking at all the wrecks up and down the thing, you had every reason to worry. But one didn't see ships sunk every day. It was more dangerous than the Mediterranean, I felt.
And how long were you doing this for, these East Coasts?
On the East Coast, I think a couple of months only, two or three months. At one time, I got flu in the middle of all that, too, at one stage, and had to go off and stay with my girlfriend's family, which was the nearest one, down in Maidstone. But I was only out of the ship about a week, I think. And I don't think she went to sea during that time. I can't remember now. But we were clearly being groomed to go back to Belfast and to join the Western Apaches, where there was a greater threat. But not until after the invasion. And we got huge chunks of paper being sent in, which were the secret orders for the invasion. And our role turned out to be that of pretending to be a support force intending to land north of where we actually landed, in the part of Calais. And so during the time of the invasion, we were at sea broadcasting preset messages to persuade the German intercept stations that we were part of a force going up there. And it would seem from history that Hitler bought it.
Was there any countermeasures? I mean, being a decoy force can be extremely dangerous.
Nobody came out and looked at us. So it didn't arise.
And all that happened for you during it. You didn't go down later on?
Didn't go down to the other part of it at all, no. We eventually went round to Belfast fairly soon after that.
And what about were you based at Pollock Dock? Or were you?
Yes.
And what was the setup at Belfast? Because a lot of the captains seem to have been based there, the escort
Lots
group.
Of there, yes.
Which escort group were you in?
21st Escort
is
Group.
Is this where you joined them?
Yes. It was known that we were part of the 21st Escort Group with Conn as the leader, but we hadn't actually sighted Conn at that stage because she was already elsewhere, or maybe she was up in Belfast already. The arrangements in up in Belfast, Pollock Dock, we met our leader, the Escort Group 21, in HMS Conn. Now, the man's name was Ray Hart. He was a lieutenant commander, RN. And I recently found his obituary, Times obituary. And he was obviously both a brave man and a very successful man indeed. He'd been much decorated. And he was a very nice man, too. I actively enjoyed meeting him and working with him. He was about the same age as my older brothers, as it happened. And that perhaps made it easier personally for me. But curiously, his first tenant was a man whom I'd known from school. Although I hadn't been at school with him, I was at school with his younger brother, and indeed had been a partner who won various public school things with the younger brother. And Peter Kershaw was the name of the first tenant concerned. And we had a very good liaison indeed. He was an RNVR officer. Indeed, his family, I think, was a brewing family. And he was due to attend the reunion of the destroyer escorts a few weeks ago, and probably would have been invited to make the speech that I was being invited to make, but unfortunately he died in the meantime. and left several million pounds, I noticed. A delightful man, but we'll come back to that later. The Pollock Dock itself was a fairly bleak end of Belfast, which was different to any other place I'd been to. I'd not been to Ireland before at that stage. And I found that on certain ceremonial occasions they were quite prepared to stop all the traffic by burning motor car tires at the crossroads, and it seemed, for Auld Lang Syne's sake, they were doing things which didn't seem quite as warlike as I would have expected. On the other hand, you could get food which was not obtainable in England, and cream and butter and milk and various things which were marvellous to go ashore and have that sort of luxury, we felt.
How did you get on with the Irish?
My family was Irish, which made it easier. My mother's family came from County Cavan, and they were, in the previous century, they'd been sufficiently Irish themselves to always to join in the local blood sports of shooting the other side, which was normal, I think. But they always finished up with more sheep, I think, afterwards. And so mother's mother was born in Australia, because all five of the Latimer brothers had gone to Australia. And mother was born on a sheep place in Australia.
And were they friendly towards the ship's companies, or was there?
Yes, very friendly. They had excellent relations ashore with various families. I was made extremely welcome in the family of the leader of it had been the chief steward of the ferry between Belfast and Larne, I think. Two pretty daughters and all the things, charming place, and they ran a small hotel, so I always had somewhere to go when I was ashore. And the sailors went ashore and had magnificent parties. They didn't get beaten up when they were ashore. I think by then they were sufficiently coherent that they would have put up a good fight had that occurred, but it didn't.
What about the harbour authorities, the dockyard authorities?
I didn't come in touch very much with the dockyard authorities, but there were wrens ashore that did some of the maintenance of the ships. Hedgehog, for example, was maintained by a girl called Kathleen Bigger. And Kathleen Bigger was a doctor's daughter who'd done partial training as a nurse, and she was also very good indeed at maintaining a hedgehog, which was her job. And she and two friends, who also had maintenance jobs on board, always made a point of meeting Byron when we came into harbour and being on the jetty to wave us goodbye when we went to sea.
Did you find it strange at the time, having women working on this sort of work, or was it just accepted as normal by then?
Well, the shock horror bit had come at Devonport when we arrived back home in Tartar and found wrens doing things. And by then we'd adapted quite easily to the idea of having nice girls doing jobs around the ship. I think that was a delightful thing.